This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Daughter Detox, Recovering from an Unloving Mother and Reclaiming Your Life by Peg Streep. Narrated by Callie Bollier. Introduction. Every week I get messages from women, left as comments on my blog posts, on my Facebook page, and in email, that say the same thing. I always thought I was the only one with a mother who didn't love her. I feel better knowing that I'm not alone. They usually add, I'm so relieved to discover that I'm not crazy or imagining that this happened. You have no idea how long I've worried. Actually, I do. I was an unloved daughter myself. These women are all ages, from early 30s to mid-80s, and from all walks of life. They are stay-at-home moms, cashiers, doctors, hairdressers, lawyers, professors, secretaries, salespeople, and even therapists. In almost every case, their outward achievements belie how they really feel about themselves. They are still made unhappy by their childhoods, despite the work they do and the families they've raised. They are women who have become devoted mothers, but who are still hobbled and hurt. They are women who recognize that they've never reached their full potential, who have hurtled from one relationship disaster to another, unable to get off the merry-go-round. Some have had children, while others deliberately chose not to, afraid of repeating history. Some have battled depression, disordered eating, or addictive behaviors, and are only now beginning to see how their behaviors connect to their childhoods. They are women who still want their mother's love and struggle with setting boundaries, wanting to attend family celebrations but still needing to protect themselves. They are women who have chosen to divorce their mothers, opting for peace along with self-orphaning over the status quo. If you are hearing these words, you are most likely one of these daughters, and no, you are not alone. In fact, you have more company than either you or I would ever have imagined. You believed, and perhaps still believe, as did my younger self, that you were to blame for your mommy's not loving you. You were afraid, just as I was for many years, to tell anyone, because you wanted to be like all the other daughters, the ones who were hugged by their mothers and whose moms smiled when they came into the room. You discovered, when you did confide, that people thought you were being dramatic because your mom seemed perfectly nice to them, and you were fed and clothed, weren't you? You were probably hopeful, and you might even be now, that somehow you'd still get your mother to love you. Somehow, maybe tomorrow, or the next day, or the next. Ours is a story no one wants to hear. Everyone wants desperately to believe that, in a world where love is so hard to find, and even harder to hang on to, one kind of love is inviolable, a mother's love. The truth of the unloving mother who actively wounds, dismisses, or disparages her child in words and actions is a cultural secret no one wants to acknowledge. We suffer alone and in silence in a sea of pastel-tinted sentiments plastered on T-shirts and mugs that say, "Home is where Mom is," and "World's Best Mom." Over the last few years, I've come to see that the sense of isolation, of being singled out in this way, of being labeled as damaged or less than, of being afraid that there is something terribly wrong with you, is just as wounding as the lack of mother love itself. The hole left in our hearts fills with shame, self-doubt, and sometimes self-loathing, but the discovery that there are others like us, that this is actually a shared experience for countless numbers of girls and women, is liberating. Daughter Detox offers a route to the way out. That's why I wrote this book. It's filled with stories told to me over the years by daughters whose experiences, while they differ in the details, hurt and change them just as ours did. But even more important, Daughter Detox lays out strategies drawn from science to get out from under the influence of the past so that you can finally become you, not just your mother's daughter. I've written it so that you can come to recognize and understand your childhood experiences, see how they have shaped the person you are in the moment, and take action to help yourself heal and grow into the very best version of yourself. It's the book I wish I'd had when my mother's voice still played on an endless tape loop in my head. I'm sure you, too, have struggled with that tape. The one that says you're inadequate, unlovable, stupid, difficult, worthless, fat, or any other variation on the theme. This book will help you understand the process that internalized that voice and help you locate an off button once and for all, and, more important, find another tape, one composed by you, to play. How to use this book. Each chapter of Daughter Detox focuses on a step-by-step process to guide you through the 7 stages of reclaiming your life and recovering from childhood. The process includes expanding your understanding of the circumstances of your life, hearing stories shared by other daughters, and then using strategies and techniques that are meant to help you move forward. You are working on undoing damage done over the course of many years, so you may find yourself needing to go back to a previous chapter, even if you've already heard it. That's to be expected. Recovery isn't a linear process. Because I'm neither a therapist nor a psychologist, I've drawn on strategies suggested by psychological and other research and, in some cases, steps that have worked for me as an unloved daughter who had to reclaim herself. This book isn't a substitute for therapy, of course, since nothing works quite as well or effectively as one-on-one work with a gifted counselor. Here are the 7 steps and what each of them entails. Journaling exercises for helping you heal, organized by chapter and stage, can be found in Chapter 10. Discovery. For many daughters, though not all, the first problem is recognizing the mother wound. There are many reasons, some complicated, some simple, that understanding the connection between the pain and unhappiness you feel and your mother's treatment of you is very hard for many daughters. Even for those who recognize at a young age that their mothers don't love them as a mother should, I was one of them, the full understanding of what this means and how it shapes you in every meaningful way is a slow revelation. The first 2 chapters of the book are devoted to discovery. Discernment. Understanding the relational patterns in your family of origin is the goal of this next step. Recognizing how the other people in your early and later life contributed or detracted from your mother's treatment of you is part of your growth. This includes how your father behaved and the attitudes of siblings and other people who formed a part of your childhood world. This step moves past discovery into the path of fully understanding the emotional connections you were exposed to and how they shape your personality, your view of yourself, and your thoughts and emotions. Teasing out how your own behaviors were formed in response to your treatment by your mother and others is the second stage of discernment. Figuring out your own patterns of attachment, whether you are anxious or avoidant, is part of this step, as are beginning to recognize triggers and starting to work on coping mechanisms to thwart them. Chapters 3 and 4 focus on discernment. Distinguish. You're not in your childhood room anymore, but the chances are good that you are bringing the relational patterns of the past into the present, and not just with your mother. Getting to the root of your own unhappiness in the present, whether that's an inability to maintain friendships or intimate connections, a sense of isolation, being unable to connect to anyone, constantly fighting with someone you know you love, or a series of relationships that make you feel marginalized or less than, is part of being able to distinguish older patterns, which are covered in Chapter 5. Disarm. This is the heart of Daughter Detox. Figuring out how not to be the little girl in your childhood home. All of the previous steps lead to this path, but it isn't a slam dunk. Why? It is about both her and you. And you have to bring the unconscious patterns in your behavior, formed in response to your mother's behaviors, into conscious awareness. specific strategies to deal with ruminative patterns of thought, recognizing emotional triggers, learning to identify and process emotions more productively, and more are the focus of Chapter 6. Reclaim. This step tackles how to go about changing your thinking and reactions so that you can move on to a new phase of your life. Learning how to harness your motivation so that you can achieve new goals, practical steps for achieving earned secure attachment, and using techniques that help you to reframe your thoughts to stay on track are all part of Chapter 7. Redirect. One of the key decisions you'll make as you move forward is redefining your relationship to your mother and most probably other members of your original family. Chapter 8 specifically focuses on helping you decide whether or not you should or can continue to be in contact or not. It details the pros and cons of continuing the relationship and what obstacles and barriers you're likely to face as you put boundaries in place. The decision to go no contact, its perils and rewards, is also explored in depth. One of the main goals of the redirect step is to enhance your ability to feel self-compassion and, indeed, to mother yourself. Recover. The final stage involves seeing the healing process as one that is ongoing and that really incorporating self-acceptance and self-compassion into your life remains a daily task. Using the Japanese art of kintsugi as its primary metaphor, this step requires you to understand healing in a different way and to make peace with the pace of the process. Chapter 10 is devoted to exercises key to each of the stages of a recovery. You can do them after listening to each chapter or at any other time. About the exercises in Daughter Detox. Most of the work involved in reclaiming your life from the effects of a toxic childhood is about bringing unconscious patterns of thinking and feeling to the surface so that they can be changed through consciousness. It's all about connecting the dots. A great deal of research attests to the fact that much of what we think is, in fact, not governed by rational and conscious deliberation, but by automatic, unconscious thought processes that the brain uses as shortcuts. To use psychologist Daniel Kahneman's terms, slow thinking versus fast thinking. Thought processes are also affected by what are called primes in the environment, as research by John A. Barge and Tanya L. Chartrand showed. So the environment in which you do these exercises, including journaling, matters. Choose a place to sit that makes you feel calm and focused. If a pile of unpaid bills or a sink full of dirty dishes is part of your visual landscape, you're not going to be fully focused. Being in a well-lit space is important. Carve out enough time to do the exercises without interruption. If you are in therapy, do not do these exercises without discussing them with your counselor first. Journaling. Research by James Pennebaker and others has shown that writing helps us not just to make sense of our experiences, but also permits us to create a coherent narrative of them. Creating a coherent narrative, connecting the dots between cause and effect, is an important part of healing from a toxic, abusive, or chaotic childhood. Writing has been shown to be a therapeutic tool provided you follow some simple rules. Pick a notebook or a blank book for journaling rather than using single sheets of paper. You should write by hand rather than using a tablet or computer because writing longhand uses a different brain circuitry. There's scientific research, too, that shows we remember and think more clearly when we write by hand rather than type. Remember that this isn't a test, and if writing makes you anxious, start by writing down phrases or words instead of full sentences. What to do when you are journaling and what to avoid. When you are writing about the past, make sure you are recalling why you felt as you did, not what you felt. Focusing on why you felt as you did is done best by recalling an event or experience as if from a great distance or as if it happened to someone else. This is called cool processing. The problem with remembering what you felt, which is called hot processing, is that if the feelings are vivid enough, they can actually put you emotionally back in the moment, act as a trigger for rumination, and effectively set you back a step or two. If you find yourself hot processing, remembering the pain you felt as a child when your mother taunted you or ignored you, or recalling a moment when you felt hopelessly alone and adrift, stop writing immediately. You need to be able to recall in a cool way. The first stop is discovery. It's the first baby step in the direction of understanding and, ultimately, healing. Chapter 1. The Truth About Maternal Power. I've spent the last 25 years trying to get my mother's voice out of my head. The voice that tells me it's just a matter of time until everyone realizes I'm not who I seem. The tape still plays when I get anxious, but most days I can muddle through and ignore it. Alexis, 40. The baby girl, just 1 month past her first birthday, is perched on the long plexiglass table, her hands and chubby knees touching its cool, smooth surface. She's round-faced and smiling at her mother, who's on the other side out of reach. Even though she's not walking yet, this baby in her pink coveralls is a confident crawler. She's calm and more curious than anything else about her unfamiliar surroundings. The plexiglass she's on is part of a very famous experiment called the Visual Cliff, originally designed and conceived of by scientist Eleanor Gibson to test whether depth perception was innate or learned. The idea came to this mother of two as her young children played near the edge of the Grand Canyon on a family vacation while she fretted about their safety. In the experiment, a checkerboard pattern lies flush under the plexiglass for half of its length, but then the fabric slants some 4 feet, creating the illusion of a sheer drop beneath the solid surface. Gibson and her colleague Richard Walker tested rats, kittens, puppies, and baby goats, as well as human infants, and discovered that once an animal or infant was old enough to locomote, depth perception had kicked in, causing them to screech to a halt at the sight of the drop. Babies crawled readily across the shallow end, but only a very few dared to take on the deep end. Even when there was a toy placed at the end to lure them, babies typically stopped their crawling at the point of the illusion of a drop-off. James Source and his colleagues took the cliff experiment one step further, exploring what a one-year-old does when her eyes are telling her one thing, yikes, there's a drop ahead, while her palms and knees, solid against the plastic, are telling her another. When her sensory perceptions contradict each other, how does she resolve the ambiguity? She looks to her mother for guidance. The researchers had the baby's mother stand on the deep end and assume various facial expressions. It's in this experiment, among others, that the extent of maternal power becomes crystalline. When the researchers had the mothers look happy and smiling, they discovered that an astonishing 74% of the babies began crawling and kept going, even over the deep end. The signals conveyed by their cheery mother's faces, all is well, you're safe, caused the babies to ignore the danger of a drop ahead that their own senses registered. In contrast, an angry face from their mothers on the other side was enough to stop every baby in his or her tracks. Some babies actually retreated, crawling backward at the sight of their mother's disapproving expressions. What's extraordinary about the results of the visual cliff isn't just that one-year-olds seek out and react to the emotions their mothers express, but that they rely on them sufficiently to override their own sensory perceptions about what is safe and what is dangerous. That's called total trust. After all, the baby doesn't know the drop isn't real. This and other experiments revealed that an infant is hardwired to use her mother's expressions, tones of voice, and behaviors as her lodestar for navigating life long before she understands words or the complexity of the world. It's a process that appears to begin even before birth. One study showed that the heart rates of near-term babies in utero increased when tapes of their mothers reading poems were played and slowed when they were played a tape of a stranger's voice. Babies are born recognizing their mother's voices, can distinguish them from other female voices, and can identify their mothers by smell. Infants as young as 5 days old undergoing a neonatal heel pin prick can even derive comfort from smelling the scent of their mother's breast milk. They have been shown to self-soothe faster and cry less than babies exposed to the scent of a stranger's breast milk or formula undergoing the same pin prick. Another experiment showed that a mother's voice calmed and stopped agitated motor movements in babies 1 to 4 days old. Because it takes a human infant so long to reach maturity and take care of herself, compared to a newt or duckling or fawn, say, evolution has assured that she is exquisitely sensitive to her mother, adept at reading her cues in the most subtle ways. That is not, as we'll see, always a bonus, since evolutionary adaptation is focused on aiding survival in times of stress, not necessarily on fostering psychological well-being. Adaptation, it turns out, is a yin-yang thing. Notably, there's no parallel evolutionary development of responsiveness in human mothers. There's only the reproductive equipment to bear a child and produce breast milk, a mix of hormones, but not an innate ability to nurture or love. In truth, elephants are more instinctually suited to mother well than humans. This is perhaps unnerving news for most people who like to believe that being a good mother is something that comes naturally and automatically. In fact, some infant and toddler behaviors appear to have evolved with the absence of hardwiring of mother's love taken into account. To make sure that mothers don't forget their babies, either in the fields during hunter-gatherer times or at the mall or in a car seat today, the infant's cry is pitched in such a way to get the attention of the adult brain. That's why you can't sleep through that baby's wail on a crowded plane, even though it's not yours, and you may not even be a parent. A study by Katie Young and Christine Parsons showed that the more primitive parts of the brain were activated by the sound of an infant's cry within 100 milliseconds. Yes, that's 1/10 of a second. Basically, that means that your brain is on high alert before you've even consciously registered the cry. And if you're wondering, none of that happens when adults sob, dogs bark, or cats meow. And it gets even more interesting. Consider whining, for example. Why whine? Scientists asked. Why not grunt or wheeze or yell? Like that high-pitched infant cry, the pitch and modulation of the whine are much more effective than other sounds in terms of intruding into and penetrating a mother's consciousness. In fact, the whine, as shown in a study by Rosemarie Sokol Chang and Nicholas S. Thompson, was the most effective way of distracting participants so that they couldn't even perform the simplest of subtraction tasks. So babies are not just hardwired to need their mother's attention and love, but also come equipped with behaviors that make it hard for their mothers to ignore them. You can think of infants as heat-seeking missiles in search of love, protection, and attunement. This is why, if your connection to your mother has been fraught, difficult, or downright damaging, a very big part of you still wants and needs her love, no matter what. There doesn't appear to be an expiration date on that need either. More than half of the time, children get what they need to thrive and to explore the world with a reliable person, their mother, as a safe home base. This is called secure attachment, a psychological construct first proposed by John Bowlby and later expanded by his student Mary Ainsworth. It was Ainsworth's experiment, The Strange Situation, that shed new light on the mother's power and influence and her ability to shape how her child connected to the world at large, not just in childhood, but also throughout life. Appreciating the strange situation. Ainsworth's line of inquiry went beyond the automatic responses supplied by evolutionary hardwiring and looked at how the infant's experiences with her mother shaped her innate responses. What she discovered would revolutionize not just the understanding of the extraordinary and lasting influence a mother has on her offspring, but would also shine a bright light on why some individuals are able to forge close and sustaining emotional connections, and others aren't. The strange situation was a series of staged encounters, beginning with the mother and child coming into the unfamiliar lab room. The mother would sit back as the child played and explored the room. Then a stranger would enter, speak to the mother, and approach the infant. While the baby was distracted, the mother would leave the room. The child would realize her mother was gone, and the stranger would interact with the child. Afterward, the mother would return and comfort the child while the stranger left. The mother would again exit, and the child would be alone in the room. The stranger would enter and respond to the child. Finally, the mother would return, pick up the infant, and the stranger would exit inconspicuously. Ainsworth hypothesized that, deprived of her mother, the child would go through reliable stages of response, that her mother's presence would make her feel safe enough to explore an unfamiliar place, that distress and protest would be the response to her mother's disappearance, that she'd show predictable wariness of the stranger when she was alone with her, and that she'd be calmed by her mother's return. And that's precisely what happened with more than half of the babies. But significant numbers of children, more than 30 to 40% of them, behaved in ways that were highly unexpected. Some of the babies derived no comfort from their mother's presence in the unfamiliar room and didn't try to explore. Some didn't react when left alone with the stranger and displayed little affect when their mothers returned. Others showed distress when their mothers left, but then either ignored their mothers when they came back or actively pushed them away. Still others cried and fussed even after their mother came back, wailing as they clung to her. What made the quality of these connections so different? What, if anything, had taken place between mother and child in the past so that the behaviors typical of these securely attached were supplanted by other patterns? What happens when a baby doesn't get what she needs? If you're listening to this book because you are an unloved daughter, and the odds are good that you believe you are, you already have emotional knowledge of what not getting what you need from your mother feels like. But few of us understand the full impact an unloving mother has. To recover from the wounds of childhood, we have to be able to see them first. To start, let's look at the science that explains, in part, how you were affected by your experiences in infancy and early childhood. Naming the problem. I spent my childhood and most of my early adulthood trying to get my mother's attention. I was an only child, but you can forget that coddled, fussed-over thing. My mom ignored me, literally. I tried everything I could to please her and get her to see me, but she never did. She still doesn't. Lydia, 37. Ainsworth began to see consistent patterns in maternal behavior that produced relatively reliable responses in their infants and called these children insecurely attached. Within that grouping, she distinguished between those who were avoidantly attached and those who were ambivalently attached. Her student, Mary Main, later added a third category, disorganized attachment, which results from physical abuse and extreme neglect. These categories aren't the result of hard wiring, but of experience, and they influence the child's development in profound and lasting ways. The interactions between the infant and her mother shape the infant's developing brain and her ability to self-regulate and calm herself. It's a dyadic dance as a responsive mother reads her child's cues, her facial expressions, her vocalizations, her movements, and gives her what she needs in the moment. The securely attached child has her needs reliably and regularly answered. She is comforted when she's afraid, held when she feels lonely, fed when she's hungry, soothed when she's overtired. given space when she needs to calm down, and feels safe enough to explore a room away from her mother's side. She seeks proximity when she needs it, but as she gets older, she also becomes confident in herself. Her mother is attuned to her, and she, in turn, will become attuned to the changes in her mother's expressions and gestures. This interaction shapes behavior and the development of the infant's brain. The latest neuroscience confirms that brain development is both a function of programming and of environmental influence, the most important of which is the mother-caregiver relationship to the infant. When a mother is attuned and the child is securely attached, development proceeds in an optimal fashion. But insecure attachment produces different results in infant behaviors, the brain, and the ability to self-regulate. Unless the mother's early behaviors are caused by something temporary, she initially suffers from postpartum depression from which she recovers. She has an illness that affects her behavior, which is then treated. They are likely to remain consistent. What begins in her daughter's infancy continues through her early and middle childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, and adulthood, unless there is some kind of therapeutic intervention or change in awareness. Remember that the child comes with the heightened ability to sense her mother's reactivity. We can thank evolution for that, since the baby's survival depends in a very literal way on this one person. Avoidant and ambivalent attachments are the baby's way of dealing with a mother who is either never emotionally present or attuned, or sometimes there and sometimes not, but never in the right balance. Rather than experience stress every time her mother doesn't respond to her or over-responds to her, the baby distances herself by either avoiding contact with her mother, this is avoidant attachment, or responds ambivalently because her mother's responses have, in the past, been unreliable. Do babies experience stress? You bet. Another famous experiment, this one called the still face, demonstrates not only how desperately a baby needs her mother's love and attunement, but also the cascade of emotions and efforts released in the baby when her needs aren't met. Originally conducted more than 40 years ago by Edward Z. Tronick and his colleagues, the results have been successfully replicated many times over by different experimenters and make it clear how truly stressful it is for a baby not to get a response from her mother. When it was first published in 1978, accompanied by a then-novel video of the interaction, this experiment made quite a splash, demonstrating that an infant, even as young as 4 or 5 months, could be an active participant in interactions instead of existing solely as a small being on whom the mother projected feelings and responses. In the video, the experimenters first have the mother interact with the child, making eye contact, smiling, and talking. The child responds with smiles, vocalizations, wiggling in her seat, and pointing her finger at various things in the room. She is thoroughly and deliciously engaged. Then the mother turns away, and the baby looks up to see a frozen, impassive, unsmiling face. At this point, the baby is still game, and she starts doing all the things mommy normally reacts to, smiling, waving her arms, pointing, vocalizing, but the face stays the same. What happens next is both amazing and heartbreaking in its own way. The infant starts to fret, turning away from the still face, protesting with her arms, and finally beginning to wail. If you watch the video, you'll witness a meltdown in progress as the baby literally slumps in her chair. Only at the end, when the smiling mommy reappears, this is an experiment after all, does the infant begin to calm down. She doesn't return to her earlier level of connection, though, so it appears she hasn't forgotten. If she were able to talk, she might say, "Yay, my mommy's back. Boy, that was scary. I don't know if it will happen again, but I hope it doesn't." But imagine if this were the baby's daily experience. A pattern of either a mother with a consistently still face, one who ignored her baby's cues consistently, or one who switched back and forth from lack of response to intrusive responses. Yes, one pattern yields avoidant attachment and the other ambivalent. In one of his articles, Edward Tronick has us imagine a game of peekaboo as played by an attuned and loving mother who is watching her child's responses. She'll understand when the play gets too intense and the baby pulls back, averting her gaze and sucking on her thumb, that she's trying to self-regulate. That mother pauses for a moment, allowing the baby space, looking at and talking to her, and then, when the baby's ready, continuing their play. On the surface, this is just a game of peekaboo, but in fact, this is an ongoing conversation and a teaching moment in which the mother enables her child to begin to regulate emotion. Too wound up? Her gestures ask, and then she provides the solution. That's okay. Just take a moment. These interactions, as we'll see, provide the laydown for neuro patterns in the infant's brain and are the building blocks for what will, over time, become mental models of how relationships work, as well as the first seeds for the growth of emotional intelligence. In contrast, there's the unattuned mother who initiates the game and then, seeing the baby withdraw, moves her face closer to the baby's face and starts clucking her tongue, trying to get the baby's attention, even if she is turning away. The baby starts fussing and may even push the mother away with her hands, but the mother doesn't stop. She's not paying attention to the infant's cues. The more the mother intrudes, the more the baby retreats, physically and emotionally, and by the end, the baby is staring out into space. This isn't just a failed game of peekaboo, but a failure of communication that, if it is a consistent pattern of interaction, will have a real impact on how the daughter develops. The still face experiment, in all of its variations, gives us insight into how both the mother and her baby participate in these early communications and how formative they are in terms of the baby's development. Of course, only one person in the dyad has the power to change the interaction, and yes, that's the mother, not the so-called cranky or unresponsive baby. Most important, the still face experiment permits us to see why some children become avoidant or ambivalent in their attachments. Of course, it's not possible for a mother to be on and attuned all the time, no matter how loving she is. These interactions aren't scripted. Humans are decidedly imperfect, and yes, exchanges can get messy at times. But as Tronick and others assert, it's the mother's ability to repair mistakes in the interactive process that matters. Here's an example, adapted from Tronick, which has special resonance for me because my own daughter was an inveterate hair puller, and boy, it not only hurt, but it was a true test of my own ability to manage my emotions. Imagine me on the floor playing with my baby. Suddenly, my daughter leans forward, grabs a hunk of my hair, and pulls hard. My reaction is swift and reactive. I scream, ow, my face contorts in pain and anger, signaling a threat to my little girl, and I unthinkingly swat her hand away. My daughter lets go and puts her hands in front of her face as if ducking a blow. I rub my scalp, then look back at my baby and start the work of repair, reaching out to her, making soothing sounds, coaxing her to reconnect. It takes a few minutes. There's been a breach in communication after all, but my daughter begins to smile and move back toward me. But what I took pains to do isn't the only possible scenario, of course. Imagine the mother totally losing it, growling and screaming at the baby, or, even worse, hitting her or pulling her hair to teach her a lesson. The mother gets up off the floor, still angry, and pays no attention at all to the baby's reactions. There's no effort at repair. In the course of a day, a week, or a month, there are many opportunities for mother-child interactions to go slightly awry or totally off track, and equally as many opportunities for reunion and reattunement. The power to fix things, though, remains totally in the mother's hands. Lest you think that there's a certain amount of reading in on Tronic and his colleagues' part, infants can't tell us what they're thinking or feeling after all, it's useful to look at another experiment involving the still face, this time conducted with toddlers who were 2.5. Developmentally, these children were light years ahead of the babies, aged 2 to 12 months, originally studied. Not only did they speak, but they knew about standards of behavior, how they and other people are supposed to act. The responses of toddlers to the still face were variations on the theme seen with much younger infants, validating the earlier findings and quelling criticisms that the researchers were projecting emotions onto infants. Confronted with their mother's unresponsive faces, these toddlers tried various strategies. Addressing mom in a louder and louder voice, maybe she isn't answering because she doesn't hear me. Waving a toy or object in her face, mom, are you awake? Even tugging at her in frustration. And like the infants, when all of their efforts to get things back on track failed, the toddlers turned their backs on their mothers, choosing to avoid contact rather than experience the cascade of negative feelings that ensues from being shut out. It's in this way that avoidant behavior becomes the default setting when a mother is unresponsive. These scenarios demonstrate the effect on infants and toddlers when a mother is emotionally unavailable. What they don't address is the dynamic when the conversation between mother and child becomes orally driven. It's at this juncture, when the child herself speaks and is old enough to understand, that the unloving mother has another weapon at her disposal. Words. How she uses her words by withholding praise and support or by actively undermining, criticizing, or dismissing her daughter will determine the kind of damage she does to her daughter's sense of self. From her first moments on the planet, the baby is busy making sense of the world around her. If she is responded to regularly and consistently, she begins to understand the world as a fundamentally reliable place where she can count on love and security and responsiveness. As she grows, what her mother says about her will become the foundation of her sense of self. But if she and her needs are ignored or unmet, the interactions with her mother will diminish her. Each of these moments of mother-child synergy alone is feather-light, but repeated again and again, these interactions have enough force to transform a child's inner landscape in ways that are more literal than not. Like a steady stream of single drops of water on soil, they create grooves and channels through which daily events flow, are interpreted, and reacted to. These channels or mental models are unconscious processes that lie below the surface of conscious thought. The words that are said to a daughter, whether they're supportive and caring or hurtful and critical, are internalized as truths about herself and how connections between humans work. Because these mental models form unconscious patterns that motivate and direct a daughter's behaviors in childhood and later, they cannot be altered without first recognizing them and bringing them to the surface of consciousness. This is why the wounds of childhood are so difficult to repair and why healing from them is complicated. Paradoxically, while the daughter feels unloved, she often can't see the ways in which she is wounded. Additionally, the hardwired need for her mother's love never abates, even as she seeks to protect herself by withdrawing, just as she did as an infant. This is the predicament all unloved daughters face. Bad is stronger than good. I do remember that I was 3 or 4 and she dressed me like a doll. I have the photos and she's holding me like a doll too, away from her body like an object, not cradling me affectionately. The attention is on how well she's doing with me, her DIY project. I also remember being punished if I played in those clothes or got them dirty or got my undies wet. Every photo shows her beaming with her prize in hand, and the little girl, me, isn't smiling. Pictures don't lie. Now I can see the truth. Abigail, 52. It's a psychological truism that bad is stronger than good, meaning that negative events have a much more significant and a lasting impact on us than good ones, despite the fact that we have many more days and years that are basically good than bad over the course of a lifetime. Think about how detailed your recall is of a bad encounter or traumatic event, and then compare it to a memory of a day when nothing went wrong. It's the bad times that stand out. Long after our memories of our beach vacation fade, we still remember the absolute nightmare of the plane ride back and the loud, drunken idiot sitting in front of us, capped by the loss of our luggage when we landed. We can thank evolution for our sensitivity to negative experiences, since the most reactive of our forebears were more likely to survive than those who didn't register possible dangers, as were those who committed untoward events to memory with as much detail as possible. Remembering how someone standing under a tree was struck by lightning and died, for example, or that a certain cave flooded when it rained, could mean the difference between survival and death. Having those specific bad experiences easily retrievable from memory was beneficial. Indeed, bad and painful events are stored in a different place in the brain than good ones. This is our evolutionary legacy, and it remains true for all of us, all these millennia later. This means that a child's not getting what she needs has a greater impact on her than actually getting it. While getting love and attention will allow her to thrive, it will not change her. In contrast, deprivation, neglect, and stress all leave their marks on personality, sense of self, the working models of relationships, and the ability to self-regulate. As the song goes, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. That's pretty much that. Happiness or feeling good doesn't require emotional process. But because bad things have a greater impact, they release negative emotions, which do require processing. Remember the game of peekaboo I described or the hair-pulling incident? In both of those cases, an attuned mother works to help the baby regulate her negative emotions, learning to self-soothe when overstimulated, recovering from feeling sad or scared, being able to calm down, and to derive comfort from someone else. Anxious and avoidant children of unattuned mothers don't learn how to deal with their negative feelings. This, as much as anything else, shapes all of their behaviors from childhood through adulthood and is, in many cases, hobbling. The fact that bad is stronger than good shows up in research pertaining to family dynamics in many different ways and should be kept in mind as you listen to this book and begin to process your own experience of childhood. Even in healthy and loving families, for example, seeing a brother or sister treated differentially by a parent, getting more attention or love, being treated as special in some way, influences a child's development and perception more than the love she actually receives from that parent. Poignantly, one group of researchers wondered whether the presence of a reasonably attentive and affectionate parent could offset the damage done by a verbally aggressive one, and discovered that, alas, it couldn't. In fact, the effects of parental verbal aggression and parental verbal affection seem to operate independently of each other. More tellingly, while verbal affection on its own appeared to support healthy development, it didn't appear to offer any buffer against the ill effects of verbal aggression. So if a father is kind and loving and a mother is verbally abusive to a daughter, dad's kindnesses won't mitigate the damage done by mom one bit. It turned out, too, that a parent showing verbal affection after a display of verbal aggression did nothing to mitigate the damage done or the effect of such aggression. That early mother-child interactions create the working models of relationship each of us unconsciously stores in memory is made clear by psychological research. It's been the contribution of brain science to show that these interactions shape the very structure of the brain and all of its connections. The developing brain and maternal behavior. The last two decades have shown extraordinary new light on the workings and growth of the brain, which, science now knows, doesn't fully mature until long after childhood has officially ended, somewhere between the ages of 25 and 30. It was long thought that the maturity of the brain coincided with the end of growth in the skeleton and skull during late adolescence. Nothing could be further from the truth. The human brain develops from the bottom up. Infants come into the world with the primitive parts of the brain, those that control the autonomic functions such as breathing, fully developed. It's the higher brain, the parts that govern emotions, language, and abstract thought, that's developed over the course of the first 3 years of life. By the time a child is three, her brain will have achieved 90% of its adult size. The growth of synapses is exponential during these years, creating far more connections than the brain actually needs, and, therefore, pruning these connections is part of later childhood. There is startling evidence that the brain of a child literally adapts to the environment in which the child finds herself. Yes, that's what the work of Martin Teicher and his colleagues discovered, and the implications are very profound indeed. While our genes provide the foundation and structure of the brain, all of its connections, both neural and how the separate parts of the brain function alone and together, are shaped by experience. The truth is that the brain reacts as readily to a negative environment as a positive one, and, as psychologist Alan Shore writes, both positive and negative experiences shape the brain's structure equally, either enabling its optimal growth or inhibiting it. Once again, this is not a metaphor, but a literal statement. We can thank evolution for this adaptability. Yes, that's irony, since under stress, the brain goes into survival mode, retooling so as to deal with that stress. We've already heard how a child's development is shaped by the absence of attuned and consistent maternal behavior. But we also need to turn to the presence of negative behaviors and their effects, especially verbal abuse. Verbal abuse has an especially powerful and lasting effect on the brain. Studies have identified the areas of the brain most affected as the corpus callosum, responsible for transferring motor, sensory, and cognitive information between the two brain hemispheres, the hippocampus, part of the limbic system which regulates emotions, and the frontal cortex, which controls thought and decision-making. Psychiatrist Akemi Tomoda and others showed correlation between verbal abuse and changes to the gray matter of the brain. What this means is that these early interactions can either produce a regulatory system, the brain, that can process emotions, handle stress optimally, and enable close emotional connections, or one that doesn't. Daughters with insecure attachments generally have trouble regulating emotion, may exhibit maladaptive behaviors, and are more at risk for anxiety, depression, and poorer mental and physical health. If you experienced verbal abuse, there's no reason to despair. The saving grace is that the brain retains its plasticity, its ability to grow and make new neural connections throughout the lifespan. We will look at the effect of verbal abuse more closely in the following chapter. So while maternal treatment and verbal abuse can change the brain, the effects can be reversed. That's very good news indeed. Attachment in adolescence and beyond. Those early childhood attachments, secure or insecure, continue to be unconscious scripts that govern how girls in adolescence and women in adulthood behave in relationships, whether romantic or friendly in nature. In order to better understand the distinct patterns, psychologists have expanded the original types of insecure attachment proposed by Bowlby and Ainsworth through a variety of studies. First, Philip Shaver and Cindy Hazan proposed a three-part model of insecure attachment that was then expanded by Kim Bartholomew into four. As you listen to these descriptions, determine where you would locate yourself most of the time, because these are descriptions of behavior, and behavior may shift according to the situation. They are not as mutually exclusive as they seem. Your goal is to identify how you most often act in situations that are close and intimate. Securely attached. Secure adults have a positive view of themselves and of other people. They have strong feelings of self-worth, and they are comfortable expressing closeness. They enjoy knowing others and being known, and feel good when they are connected in love or friendship with others. They're good at identifying their feelings accurately and manage negative emotion well. They're flexible in their responses and have a variety of coping mechanisms at their disposal. They are resilient and can handle setbacks, large and small. Anxious, preoccupied. These are daughters who were anxious, ambivalent in childhood, and their behaviors carry forward. Even though they may be high-achieving, they have deep wells of self-doubt and low self-esteem. They seek validation in relationships because they have a positive view of others, but they are also volatile, clingy, and then demanding and reactive by turns. They are on a constant state of high alert, searching for signs that the people they're intimate with, whether lovers or friends, will leave or reject them, and can be triggered by the smallest of slights as a result. Generally, these women are always in one relationship or another, characterized by swings in behavior and highs and lows. Not surprisingly, these daughters often have trouble holding on to lasting friendships with other women. Dismissive, avoidant. These daughters think well of themselves and have a low opinion of others, which Bartholomew attributes to coping mechanisms adopted during a childhood with a rejecting mother. On a conscious level, they're likely to consider themselves independent and self-contained and not in need of intimate relationships for sustenance. They may come across as aloof or arrogant to others, as well as fiercely independent. Even though avoidants have relationships, they remain shallow because these daughters, deep down, don't want close connections or intimacy. Their romantic relationships remain superficial. These women look as though they are involved, but they always maintain their emotional distance from the supposed objects of their affection. In a similar way, their friendships tend to be organized around shared interests or hobbies, rather than confidences, closeness, and disclosure. Unlike the anxious, preoccupied daughters whose volatility guarantees conflicts, these daughters steer away from conflicts, perhaps because they might reveal their true vulnerability. Fearful, avoidant. The dominant word here is fear. Even though these daughters actually crave intimacy, they don't trust anyone enough to let them get close. The experiences of childhood have taught these daughters that people are uncaring and unavailable, and that they themselves are unlovable as well. All of this plays out close to the surface, since these women come across as intensely vulnerable, openly worried, insecure, and self-conscious. All three of these insecure styles can be seen as defensive postures adopted in childhood in an effort to both self-protect and reduce stress from maternal interactions. Remember how infants and toddlers turned away from their mothers in the still-face experiments? These ways of responding are really no different, but unfortunately, they are unsuccessful strategies to deal with stress and negative emotion. How happy we are largely depends on how well or badly we handle stress and the emotions that accompany it, and much of the unloved daughter's unhappiness in adulthood has to do with her difficulty in handling negative feelings. She has trouble sustaining happiness because it's so easily interrupted. Under stress, The secure daughter brings up mental representations and conscious thoughts of emotional support and positive experiences that help her manage negative emotions in the moment. She's inclined to look forward and to realize that resolutions to her problems exist. She's able to get angry without getting hostile and, even in the midst of an argument, is able to shift her thoughts to how to repair the rift. In response to stress, the anxiously attached daughter, in contrast, is more likely to remember dispiriting or painful experiences, as well as those times that she needed help and only encountered rejection. These memories arouse more anxiety.